Now, detonate the reality bomb!
I will build a great, great wall.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The truth is out there.
The military-industrial complex.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know.
Change has come to America.
Catapult of propaganda.
From a secure location on top of the ridge in the heart of the beautiful Missouri Ozarks, this is a view from the bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
The Bible tells us man does not live by bread alone, but when you don't have any bread on your table, it sure seems like the most important thing there is. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guest is one of the fellow speakers at the upcoming Hear the Watchman Conference, March 31st through April 2nd. And by the way, thank you for listening at vftb.net or watching, if you're watching on the video, at youtube.com/Derek Gilbert. If you would, take a moment to click the little icon there in the bottom right corner to subscribe so you get the updates every time we update the podcast. Of course, also releasing my novel in audio form through the podcast or through the YouTube channel as well. So you get that as a bonus. The upcoming Hear the Watchman Conference, March 31st through April 2nd at the Hilton DFW Lakes Conference Center. That's Grapevine, Texas, the Dallas metro area. 15 speakers in all, and one who, I'll be honest, I found myself in an interview on Skywatch TV a couple of weeks ago asking the coordinators of the organizers of the conference, Mike Kerr and Jeannie Moore, who is this man? Because I sadly was not familiar. And then it dawned on me after he graciously sent an email that maybe the best thing to do was just ask him directly. He is a veteran of the United States Air Force, and sir, we thank you for your service. And the author of a book that speaks to a topic I refer to on Skywatch TV pretty regularly. I just have a lowly BA in this field, economics. But it is something that will have a very important impact on you, your family, and all that you love. The Financial State of the Union is the name of the book. The website, thefinancialstateoftheunion.com. We welcome for the first time John Reagan to the program. John, good to meet you.
Yeah, thanks, Gilbert.
That's all right. I kind of look like him if I took the beard off. I actually went as Dilbert at Halloween one year with the glasses. I just wore the tie with the bent up end, and people got it right away. So no harm, no foul.
Sometimes I have to look up my own name. It's that bad.
Yeah, well, said that too. You know, just to put a name tag on me. Sometimes I get so distracted I forget where I am or what I'm doing. The Financial State of the Union. Before we dig into your analysis of where we are and where we're going, and I notice that this is book one, so I presume you've got other titles in line here. But let's back up. What was it that led you to a career looking at and analyzing the financial state of the union?
Well, I have to say it's not my plan. My plan was to get ready for what was coming.
Hmm.
And I started doing research. There's an intentional community near Dallas. It's outside of Waco. And they offer classes. And I went there in April of 2010 and took a three-day homesteading course. Hmm. And I thought that was going to answer a lot of my questions and get me set up very well. However, taught me how much I didn't know.
Mm.
And if you'd known me before then, I would have been saying you want to find or build a community because there's just so much. And after that, I was saying you need to find a community because there's not enough time to get up to speed with all the skills that we don't know anymore.
Mm.
And then my wife and I moved to the Ozarks at the end of 2010, once I completed my master's in finance and couldn't find work here in Dallas, we were going to try kind of a semi-retirement and move to what we thought was a Christian community.
Hmm.
And spent about 6 months there. So it's a working farm, but it was a dysfunctional working farm.
Hmm.
So there's still a lot of knowledge picked up from that. And once we got out of that, that's kind of a long story in itself, so I'll keep that part short. You know, I found myself, you know, really having to do a lot of soul searching because why was I led here? And it was basically 5 years ago when I went public with the financial state of the union. First at a presentation at the library there in Springfield, Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
And the group that was meeting there had a 45-minute speaking slot. And I thought I had probably an hour's worth of material and that, I'd cut that back, make it appropriate for that. And my thoughts were that once I get that done, I can just kind of promote that video and get back to my life. And you can still hear God laughing about that one. So I went to the library. I ended up speaking for an hour and a half. And the only reason it stopped then is because the library was closing. We continued on the parking lot for about another 15 minutes or so. And it was at that point I realized I had to make a book out of it. And then it was February 22nd. That was my first time on the radio, which was on the USA Prepares show.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just taken off since then. Probably the, if I had to pick a starting point for what made the financial part stick, it's probably 2007, 2008. I found an article where the president of the Dallas Fed was giving a talk. And during this talk, he said that the unfunded liabilities for Social Security and Medicare were like $65 trillion.
Right, right.
And this is at a time when the debt for the federal government was still single-digit trillions.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at that and, you know, gee, there's no way we can handle that. I started digging a little bit, and then I was ended up being part of a layoff at this company. And because of that, I took advantage of some veterans benefits in Texas, go back to school, and that's where I got my master's in finance. And that was for two reasons. My undergraduate degree is computer science, and I have an MBA in information systems, and I wanted something that was definitely more business-oriented to try and help get work. Plus, if there is a way of finding an out for the situation we're in, I figured I'd discover it during that degree.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, I didn't accomplish either of those goals.
Well, we can relate. It was about that time that my wife and I decided, well, I had my midlife crisis, and I decided I had to get back into radio after having been out for about 13 years. And we put our home in St. Louis on the market so we could take this job in Columbia, Missouri. And we were just early adopters in the real estate crash that occurred later. The market peaked earlier in St. Louis than it did anywhere else. So it was about that time that the economy was going through its crisis that most of America didn't feel until 2009 or 2010. And that's kind of what woke me up to the fact that maybe my economics degree was going to be a little more useful than I'd originally thought when I came out of college back in 84. So 2009 and 2010, you're looking at things, or in that time frame, 2008, 2007. How did the let me ask you this. How surprised were you by the subprime mortgage crisis that hit? Was that something that you saw when you began looking at the state of the American economy?
Well, if you go back to, I believe it was 2004 time frame, I had gone to an investment seminar locally where, you know, they want you to buy their education package.
Right.
And I was talking to the, you know, the good-looking woman in the back of the room that they send along to try and encourage you to buy.
Right.
And she was talking about, you know, flipping houses and all of that and how great that was. And I was telling her back then, you know, we've got a housing bubble and that's going to collapse. So I really wasn't surprised housing did what it did. It's a matter of timing. And that's true for pretty much everything else that we see. And in a way, I'm surprised things have gone on this long, but they've come up with some very inventive ways of kicking the can down the road. And if you look at what I learned in my degree, you know, we didn't talk about quantitative easing. We didn't talk about zero interest rates, much less negative interest rates. And now they're talking about, you know, universal basic income.
Right, yes. I see they're trying that in Finland, I guess, and already the labor unions in Finland are saying, hey, this is a bad idea, which is a shock.
It doesn't work. Surprise, surprise, surprise.
Paying people to stay home. Well, that's something I discovered when I spent 4 years in outside sales just before coming here to the Ozarks to begin partnering with Skywatch TV and be a part of this ministry. And the biggest problem I heard in the southern half of Illinois, which is not a heavily industrialized area, most of the work in southern Illinois is either related to the coal field, to the oil fields, which surprised me. But then I grew up in Chicago, and when you grow up in Chicago, you think nothing happens south of Interstate 80. So, you know, or it's agriculture, which makes sense. But the biggest problem that business owners and shop managers told me about, guys who were looking for welders and machinists, metal workers, was they couldn't find guys who wanted to get off the couch. This was during the period, you know, from 2011 to 2014. They were still guys who were collecting 99 weeks of unemployment after the Obama administration extended unemployment benefits to, you know, almost two full years. I had one weld shop manager tell me, I've got guys come in here with an application for a job. They don't actually want a job. They just want me to sign a piece of paper saying, yes, they applied so they could continue collecting unemployment. So that was the biggest issue. We were subsidizing unproductive behavior. So I, you know, this basic living wage, to me, it makes no sense whatsoever. But I guess now I'm finding that, like my dad at this age, I'm kind of old school because I keep repeating things I heard him say 25 years ago. Like, oh, I'm getting old.
I'm generationally out of sync because my parents were old enough to be young grandparents. Mm. So the kids that I went to school with, it was their grandparents that experienced the Depression and World War II. For me, it was my parents. And, you know, the further you get from those events, the more they become almost like, you know, myth.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't really understand them. Having spent 3 years in Europe, I got to understand it a bit better because you'd still see buildings there that, you know, have the pockmarks in them from the gunfire. Got to visit places like the American Cemetery in France, the Maginot Line. And that was the 80s, so there were still people, a large part of the population that was alive when the war happened.
Right, right.
Unlike today, where it seems like Germany's surrendered, and unless things change real fast, Europe is going to cease to exist as we know it.
So back to the inspiration for your book, The Financial State of the Union, as you began digging into things, you know, you thought this presentation at the library in Springfield was kind of a one-off. What happened then when you started digging into the research that went into the book? I mean, were you surprised? How did you, you know, what did you find and what was your reaction?
Well, it was a journey and it wasn't in any particular order. And it's kind of like, you know, panning for gold. You don't know what you're going to find when. And I turned around and put that into a journey for the book. So it's an expose more than a financial report. And it's kind of funny. I've had several people say they have to read it all at once because as you get to the end of a chapter, it's almost like a serial where I put a hook in for the next chapter.
That's good writing.
And to put the pieces together in order where you can understand it, there are so many things going on. Part of it is our money, which is essentially worthless. Beyond that, you start looking at the structural problem we have that's going to cause the problems. Everybody talks about what's now the essentially $20 trillion federal debt.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's kind of the tip of the iceberg. One of the things that's ignored is total debt for the United States is about $67 trillion.
Right.
And when you look at that, you know, that gets to be quite a burden all by itself. You also have to look at government spending, which is a significant part. And since government doesn't produce anything on their own, mm-hmm. they have to first take it from somebody else or borrow it from the future, which is a financial lesson that, you know, we don't get in school. You know, when you,
right.
when you buy things on credit, you're giving up what you could have bought in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, you're having to pay the interest. So that's that much less
right.
you're going to be able to buy in the future. And you only have so much income during your lifetime. You can do things to increase your lifetime, but when you look back, you're, whatever that amount is, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And to, we are so burdened with debt. That's one of the things that's happening with our economy right now that a lot of people don't see.
They don't realize that with the debt obligations they've taken on, we're all going to have to live to be 150 in order to pay it off, right?
Well, it's worse than that. when you look at the unfunded liabilities, and you'll see different numbers for it. One comes out of the financial report of the United States. Now, before Obama took office, these were decent numbers, even though when you look at the assumptions, the assumptions were very optimistic. But once Obama took over, now the numbers are so bad that the auditors won't even sign off on them.
Mm.
And it's, in auditor speak, it's about as close as you can get to liar, liar, pants on fire type of thing.
So this is across the board. I mean, I know that the auditors wouldn't sign off on the Department of Defense books, which right now, at last check, I think they're missing about $6.5 trillion out of the defense budget. But this is across the entire federal government's books. Auditors will not sign off on their audits?
Specifically for the unfunded liabilities, they say it does not conform to GAAP.
Generally accepted accounting principles.
Yes.
Yeah. Huh. Which means so, this $20 trillion deficit they're telling us, you only get that number if you use accounting principles that would land you and me in jail.
No, the debt is okay. It's
okay.
The unfunded liabilities, which they are saying is, I think right now, in the 70-some trillion dollar range.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
When you use GAAP, it's probably around 100 trillion.
Oh.
However, when you look at more reasonable estimates, and this is what Professor Kotlikoff does, he takes the alternate scenario from the Congressional Budget Office, does the same calculation, and that's where you see the $200 trillion number.
And that's the more reasonable number.
That's the more reasonable number.
And that's based on assumptions that are a little more reasonable in terms of expected rate of return on certain investments and lifespan and things like this?
Well, fasten your seatbelt because
okay.
I'm going to tell you two more things. One, when they say the unfunded liabilities – and the amount, whether it's for Social Security and Medicare or the pension funds that you're reading in the news, they're leaving out a couple of words.
Uh-huh.
That's present value.
Okay.
And if you've ever had, you know, you might not have had the finance course to teach you that, but basically you can go to a financial calculator and do this yourself. Say that you have a child and you want to put aside money for their college and you think that you're going to need, say, $100,000 in 18 years.
Mm-hmm.
So you plug that in, you know, the future value, you put in 18 years for the time period. You know, you pick 5% for an interest rate, which is kind of hard to get now, but
yeah.
you calculate. And I believe that ends up being around $42,000, $43,000 you would have to invest today. So that's the present value mm-hmm. of the $100,000, and it's the cheapest way of paying for that debt. So when you see those numbers, that $200 trillion that Professor Kotlikoff says, that's not what it's going to take to fix the problem. That's what you would have to put in the bank today, earning 5.6% interest in order to pay for what we've promised.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay. Compound. Yeah. When you start compounding that interest, suddenly that number gets a lot bigger.
In fact, when you dig into the Social Security trustee report and just pull out the 75-year table, the deficit just for 75 years in ordinary dollars that we're used to working with is over $200 trillion.
Mm. Now, for comparison, the United States gross domestic product is what, $14, $15
trillion? About $18 is what they say. However, you have to know how they lie about that. that's supposed to be the value of all the goods and services. However, they have ways of adjusting that. And one of them is, say, you buy a new TV and it's got a button with a new feature. The TV costs less than your previous TV, but because it's got that new feature, they say it's worth more and they'll use that higher number.
Oh, okay. That makes no sense. Well, and the other thing doesn't make any sense that contributes to the number is because, as you pointed out before, government spending, where they have to take money from elsewhere in the economy through taxing businesses and individuals before they can spend it. And yet they count government spending towards the gross domestic product.
Right.
That makes no sense to me.
And if you go in, and I've worked on this going from tax stats from the IRS, you've got what most people consider income, wages and salaries. That was about $9 trillion, probably around $10 or $11 trillion now. You've got investment income, business income, and retirement income. And when you add that together, you get a number that's probably about 20% less than this artificial GDP number. Hmm. So
instead of $18 trillion, well, that brings you back to the $15 trillion that I mentioned. So,
right.
Yeah.
So just to work with some round numbers, let's say we've got the $200 trillion. And we don't want things to get worse. That means we have to come up with about $12 trillion a year.
Mm-hmm. Which is almost...
and not spend it.
Yeah.
You know, to make up for just the interest on what you would have done.
Yeah.
And that's more than all the wages and salaries when we start adding in government spending and debt service for our $67 trillion. You'd need more than 100% of all income.
Which... last time I checked is, yeah, I mean, I'm no mathematician, but greater than 100% seems is an impossibility. It's unbelievable. I mean, global GDP is what, around, somewhere around $75 trillion?
I believe so.
So we're talking about our unfunded liabilities being at least 2 to 2.5 times, maybe even 3 times, greater than the entire economic output of the entire world. Combined economic output of the entire world. That this is how long can this go on, John?
Not very much longer. Another way of looking at it is even at the $100 trillion level, that's more than all the money in the world. So even
more than all the physical cash that's in.
No, that's using the broad definition of money.
Oh, okay, including the stuff that's only digital.
Depository accounts, everything that would be considered cash or cash-like assets.
Huh.
And, of course, the United States doesn't have all the money in the world.
No.
And even if you did have all the money in the world, then you have the problem of where would you invest it to get the rate of return that you need?
Mm-hmm.
There's the flip side. How do you reduce expenses enough to come into line with what we make? And a few years ago, I said if we deleted Social Security and Medicare out of the programs right now, we might be able to eke out. And that wasn't even considering the pension problems.
Mm-hmm.
But even if you did that, the social unrest would be so bad that right. You know, the country's got problems anyway.
Yeah, you got a lot of people who paid in all their lives. You know, my mother, she's turning 80 next month, says, hey, look, I paid in all my life. I want what's coming to me, and I'm sure she's not the only one who feels that way. So, yeah, that seems like political suicide. Even if you were able to convince people this is necessary, Most people, I think, would say, well, take it from somebody else. Find that $6.5 trillion the Defense Department's invested in Area 51 or whatever. It would be a tough sell.
And there's a couple of other ways of looking at this, because people think, okay, we can't tax enough, we can't cut enough, maybe we can grow ourselves out of this problem.
Huh.
So let's say Trump does manage an additional 2% GDP over what Obama did. And let's give him the full amount of the number, 18 trillion. You know, 2% of 18 trillion, you're under $1 trillion right there.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, at best, you're probably going to be able to tax 25% of it. But even if you could tax 100% of that, less than $1 trillion doesn't even cover what we went into the hole for last year just for the federal government.
Hmm. What is the point of this? I mean, why? And I guess I'm asking you to put yourself in the heads of those politicians who've put us into this mess. But why in the world would, and much of this increase, as you mentioned, before the Obama administration took over 8 years ago, we were already at an official debt of about $9 trillion, and now it's grown to about 20, doubled in the last. President Obama holds the record for adding the most debt to the American Treasury in history, basically, during his 8 years. But he's not the only one. I mean, we can say that he's responsible, but let's be honest. There are players behind the scenes who are pulling strings, probably people whose names we will never know, who are basically telling Obama and our senators and congressmen, this is what you're going to do. What is the goal of these people? Why do they want to drive the United States into bankruptcy? I mean, and what then for the world if that actually happens?
Well, the way if you look at things is that the United States has been hated for a long time because we're self-reliant, we're into freedom. And at least at our founding, we were a Christian nation. And the idea is if you destroy that, you end up with pretty easy control of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And this didn't start in, you know, our lifetimes. You have to go back about a century ago. You get the Federal Reserve Act and the Income Tax Amendment at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the lie for the income tax amendment, it's only going to be a small amount that only affects the rich people up in the Northeast.
Yeah, yeah.
And you see how that's turned
and
out.
And it's to pay for the world war that we're in right now. And once the war is over, we'll end it. And or did the tax precede World War One? I know that the Federal Reserve was, what, 1913, right?
That was 1913. Income tax came in about the same time there.
Okay, all right.
There was another income tax before that was temporary, and I forget exactly which war that was supposed to pay for. But you look at coming forward, up until that point, we had gold and silver as money.
Mm-hmm.
Now we had the paper version, but those were certificates.
Right.
Which means that you had the gold or the silver on deposit, and you could trade in the paper for the real thing. We now have Federal Reserve notes, and it's rather interesting that the obligatory clause that's on there, today it reads, this note is a legal tender for all debts, public and private. But when you read the one from the original Federal Reserve note, and it's rather long, and I don't have it in front of me, but it goes on to say how you can turn this in for lawful currency at the Federal Reserve Bank,
mm-hmm.
which basically tells you that the Federal Reserve note is not lawful currency.
By implication, yeah.
And you also have to understand the banking term note is a debt instrument.
It's an IOU, basically, right?
Exactly. You go in and sign a promissory note, mm-hmm. First grade terms, IOU, and that's what we're dealing with. And fiat currency is naturally unsustainable because you have to go out and say you're starting with no currency and you go to the central bank and say, we need $100 for our economy. So they lend you $100, say it's 5% interest. You come back a year later. Now you owe them $105 but you only have $100. You can never repay the central bank.
Hmm.
But that's not how it started. They started by putting some of that into, you know, circulation, and over time, you know, people could use it to buy things. So we're now in the situation we are today.
Mm-hmm.
But we had FDR go in, take the gold away from the people. We had LBJ. He also added Social Security, which.
Right, the Great Society.
That's the minor part. And I was watching a biography on him, and he knew it was not sustainable, but he figured Congress would fix it by the 1960s. Well, not only did they not fix it, LBJ put in Freudian Medicare, and which is what's really killing us. And while he didn't take silver out of the hands of people, he put in the fake coinage, the Coinage Act of 1965,
right,
giving us the sandwich coins that we have now. Mm-hmm. So the money that's actually worth something quickly disappeared out of circulation.
Mm-hmm.
A year or two after that, they did do away with the silver certificates. And it's kind of interesting that up until November 63, just shortly before JFK was assassinated, $1 bills were all silver certificates. The very first $1 Federal Reserve note was issued then.
Hmm. Hmm. So for people not familiar with the term, fiat currency simply means a currency that is not backed by a precious metal. I mean, really we didn't move off the gold standard until Nixon in 73, which meant until that point, our money supply, the amount of money in circulation was theoretically still controlled by the amount of gold in Fort Knox. Now, it's not all of Fort Knox, but that's in rough terms that is correct, is it not?
Well, he temporarily closed the gold window in 1971.
71.
That was used for international transactions. But during that time, Americans couldn't even own gold unless it was like jewelry.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go in and look at the official numbers for the gold that the United States is supposed to own, and I just did this calculation this week. It was something like, I hate to go by memory, but by the time you multiply it out at today's exchange rate of a little over $1,200 an ounce, it's not even enough to cover 1 year trade deficit. And that's why they had to close the gold windows, because if they hadn't, we would have gone bankrupt in 1971, which would have been a better thing than what we're facing now.
Because as the problem has compounded, then the amount of distance that you have to fall from where you are has grown with each passing year.
Exactly.
Yeah, the bigger they are, the harder they fall. So by decoupling the money supply from anything tangible like gold and silver, the banks have been able to inflate the money supply artificially, correct?
Yeah, and when they tell you the dollar is backed by the full faith and credit of the United States, they, in a way, are actually telling you the truth there. It's because it demands faith, because so long as you believe in it, it works.
Right.
When you stop believing in it, it's got no value.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have to look at the other. Credit sometimes gets confused with debt. Credit is what you're allowed to borrow. Debt is what you owe.
Mm-hmm.
And when our credit supply gets cut off, that's when things get really dicey.
And that's what happened in 2008 and 2009, the subprime mortgage crisis, when people weren't able to repay the mortgage loans. People took out 5-year ARMs or whatever to get into homes that they really couldn't afford and shouldn't have been allowed to buy. You know, I sold real estate for a while in the early 90s, and we were thrilled when interest rates got down to like 6.5%. It's like, whoa, this is a great thing. And suddenly the interest rates were down to like 3, 3.5, 4. And we were seeing ads in the mid 2000s, you know, 04, 05, 06 for 120% loan to value. The assumption being that real estate would always, always inflate. And suddenly when that bubble popped, credit supply was cut off and nobody could buy anything for a while. I want to ask you about something here. And before too long, I want to get to, you know, where this leads and what we as Christians should do to prepare. But this is something that over the last few years I've spent a little time reading because our daughter, who is just turning 27 this year, went through that time in her life when she was considering what to do, you know, getting out of high school. A lot of her friends went immediately into four-year college, which, frankly, for many of them was just extended high school. The degrees really don't mean as much as they used to. They don't set young people apart in the workplace like they did 50 years ago, even 30 years ago. But it does saddle them with an awful lot of debt. I think I've read the average student coming out of college now, the average college graduate between the age of 20 and 30 right now is carrying about $27,000 or $30,000 in debt. It is such a bad problem that the average, if you took two students coming out of high school, one going right into the workforce and the other going on to college, and if you just look at average numbers for those two people throughout the course of their life, the kid who went on to college, even though they come out and typically will earn more at their first job than the kid coming out of high school because of the additional debt load, never, ever financially catches up. By the time they hit retirement age at 65, the kid who went right into the workforce out of high school is in a better position financially than the kid who went to college because the cost of college has inflated, or the price of college has inflated over recent years. My meager understanding of economics, I just have a bachelor's in econ, but it seems to me the older I get, John, and I want your reaction to this, is that most of what goes on in the economic world, most financial dealings, transactions, implications, consequences, come back to Econ 101, the law of supply and demand. And if we look at the supply of money, dollars, as a commodity, like pork bellies or corn futures, we can understand why the price of real estate went up the way it did in the late 90s and 2000s, and why the cost of a college degree is inflated so much. Because the federal government has interfered in those markets and pushed money into those markets by making it easier to get loans for homes or for college degrees. And what they've done then is by putting more money into a market to chase a fairly stable supply of a product, whether it be homes or college diplomas, they've lowered the value of the money in that market. So it takes more pieces of green paper to buy a college diploma today than it did in 1984 when I graduated. Just like the little house that I had in St. Louis, what I bought in 1994 for $92,000 was appraised for $186,000 in 2006. I mean, you'd think I discovered oil in the backyard. But I think the only – now, am I correct in my simple understanding of this? Is it just simply the supply of money that the government is allowing to chase specific items? And second part of this question, how is student loan debt going to affect the American economy in the years ahead?
The student loan's a minor part of it, but let me go back to GDP for a moment. There's also a thing called inflation.
Mm-hmm.
And you can probably ask anybody on Social Security if the inflation rate matches what they see in real life.
Oh, yeah. I hear about that every time mom gets an update from the SSA.
And when you're dealing with GDP, you'll hear one of two terms, either real or nominal. Real is fake and nominal is real.
Okay.
Nominal is what we experience in real life.
Okay.
So it's like if you get in a time machine, go back to the 1960s, and you'll see gas for 20-some cents a gallon. But what they will do for financial reports, they'll adjust it for inflation, and they'll call it real. Well, when you adjust the GDP and you understate inflation, that means you're overstating GDP.
Right.
So that's one of the things. It looks like we're getting some Well, it used to look like we were getting some good increase in GDP. It's been horrible lately. And so long as they've kept inflation lower than what it really is on their books, that means the GDP really didn't even go up that much.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the malaise that we're
feeling. Because part of the number that they're reporting is actually just the rise in consumer prices. So you have to when you account for inflation, the growth in the GDP is not nearly as good as it looked.
So as the dollar becomes worth less and less on its way to becoming worthless,
mm-hmm.
you'll see prices rise. But let me drop the other shoe on the unfunded liabilities and get into the real life meaning of this. Mm-hmm. Whatever number you look at, whether it's from the Social Security trustee report or from the calculation that Professor Kotlikoff does, neither one of those take into account the jobs that are going to be lost to robotics and artificial intelligence.
Ah, see, now we keep hearing that this is going to be a good thing because it will give us all the leisure time in the world to just do productive things, to do artistic things, to enjoy life and love and art and poetry and music. And you just find a lot of people sitting at home playing Xbox.
Yeah, drugs, sex, and rock and roll.
Yeah, which gets back to the problem I talked about earlier of business owners saying the biggest problem they had was not the economy. It was finding people who wanted to get out of bed 5 days a week and show up.
But as I was talking about, we've lost sight of history.
Yeah.
When you look at – when you have really bad economic times, which we're getting to the point where we can't afford anything. Mm-hmm. And as bad as Social Security and Medicare are, that's not what I see getting ready to crash the system. It is the pension funds, which you see popping all over the place, including here in Dallas. And rising interest rates, because as the interest rates go up, that does multiple things. There's an inverse relationship between bond values and interest rates. Since we're at zero or sometimes worse in from foreign countries, interest rates, as that rate goes up, the value of the bonds go down, so that crashes the bond market. So that means all these pension funds that have a significant amount of money invested in bonds, it's going to see equity go away.
Right.
And the cost of borrowing goes up. And in the case of the federal government, where it's not just what they go in debt for this year, they're having to recycle that debt and they've borrowed it at short-term rates. So they may have to turn around $3-5 trillion in a year at these higher rates. So interest payments will go up, which makes things even worse.
Yeah.
So that's what I see crashing things. And when you get these tough economic times, historically what you see is war.
Mm.
You look at the last example would be the Great Depression here, World War II, Weimar Republic in Germany. And when you look at the toys we have to wage war with now, that's disturbing. And unlike World War I and II, where the United States was basically untouched, about the only
In terms of infrastructure anyway,
except for Pearl Harbor.
Right.
But that's minor in comparison to the whole country. It's not so today. The technology can reach us. You don't have to worry so much about an invasion. That's going to be tough to accomplish. But as far as if you want to get rid of the people, it can be done with as few as, one nuke.
Mm-hmm.
I personally use two or three.
Mm-hmm.
High altitude detonation.
Right.
You destroy all the electronics, and unlike what you might see in some TV shows, they don't come back. Mm-hmm. They're fried, and that's where it becomes so deadly, because now, not only have we lost electricity, we've lost the supply chain.
Right, and America lives on just-in-time deliveries.
There's no water, no food. And that turns very deadly very fast.
Yeah, we talked to Gary Haven, the producer of the film Armageddon, about how quickly things would get ugly, about 90% of Americans dead within a year, according to a congressional report.
And that report understates things. I came across, one of the horrifying things that I come on the radio and say is, "Hey, Vincent, I've run some numbers."
As he starts reaching for the aspirin and the antacids.
I looked at the worldwide grain supply. It's roughly a 60-day supply in the supply chain at any one time. So, and also put this in perspective, one of the people that I've had the pleasure of associating with is Marjorie Wildcraft, who is into raising her own food and teaches that. And when she was at one of the expos, her 2 minutes said that if you have anything less than 100% crop failure your first 3 years, you have a green thumb.
Wow.
Because you don't have the skills for doing this. You don't know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Even people that have been doing gardening are probably not using heirloom seeds, don't know how to save them. And there could be all kinds of other things going on as well. So that tells me if you want to live, you've got to have at least a 3-year supply of food just to get through your learning curve.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how do you do that? Because our supply chain doesn't allow for raising excess. And you look at, let's divide it out. 60 days is 1/6 of a year. And I'll round that to 15% to make it easy. 3 years, you're down to 5%. And you can't take all of the food out. So maybe you can take 10% out of our current supply chain to put aside. So that means 0.5% is the way I calculated it. So that's 99.5% fatality rate due to starvation.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing is, and this is one of the things how God works, the week that I calculated that, another USA Prepares instructor that is into raised bed gardening had a seminar, and I went there, and up to that point, only knew him as a retired engineer. At that point, he talked about, he just got back from Langley, found out he's, you know, out of the CIA, and he'd been talking to somebody there and about the fatality rate. And in his opinion, he thought this wasn't going to be that bad. It might be 60% or 70%. And his friend told him, no, it's 99.5%. Now, I don't know how they calculated their number, but to get the exact same number to the first decimal point, it's pretty amazing to me.
Yeah. No.
And in many ways, that's overly optimistic, too, because a lot of people think, well, I'm going to go out and, you know, be the heat big hunter gatherer.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yeah, good luck. Good luck with that.
It depends on where you are, but a decent average is, in order to have a sustainable hunter gatherer lifestyle, you need 10 square miles for every person.
Uh huh. Yeah. There's not that much space out there, at least not even where we're at in the Ozarks. I mean, we're beyond the reach of cable television, so, you know, we're kind of a ways out there. But I know we've got more people than that in 10 square miles around us. So, and unless you want to live an armadillo, there's not a whole lot of game wandering about to be taken.
So the one option is war, and that's pretty common because when you have these tough times – and it kind of gets back to the bread and circuses. You know, so long as people eat and have entertainment, the government can pretty much do what they want.
Mm-hmm.
However, when there's no food, they get a little upset. And that's when you start seeing the governments wanting to direct that anger outward, which goes to other countries and war.
Mm-hmm.
However, if they manage to bypass the war, that's where it gets even more disturbing because of technology. That's when you impose the one world, new world
right.
order.
That's where the savior steps up and says, ah, I've got a solution. I'll fix everything. Yeah. You may be onto that something there. Now, I know that we're getting close to time here, and in the amount of time we have left, we're certainly not going to present a full plan for where we go from here. But I guess let me ask you about the USA Prepares radio program on GCN that you're a guest host on and a regular presenter. What kind of information do people get there, and what would you recommend as far as a first step for people who want to begin to educate themselves on how do we get ready for what comes next? If assuming we're still here when things really hit the fan, what kind of information, where should we go to get the information we'll need?
Well, it's kind of daunting. Because there's so much, you just kind of have to start somewhere and prioritize. So the most important things is being able to secure your food, water, shelter, and sanitation. Water tends to be the easier, even though it's got the least time frame that you can go without, because you can get water filters, and as long as you have a water source nearby, mm-hmm. you can take care of that. Food, you either have to have stored or be able to raise it, and even the Amish, who have great skills, are going to have a hard time because they're dependent on the supply chain as well.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be concerned, especially in the wintertime, about keeping warm,
right?
Because hypothermia will kill you rather quickly. Sanitation becomes an issue, because whether or not you're in the city or in the country, if you're in the city with a sewer,
mm-hmm.
One of the things that's in the EMP report that I learned is the sewers are driven by electric pumps.
Right.
So when the power goes out, you better have a balloon where you can cut off what's going through the sewer so it doesn't come into your house.
Yeah, yeah.
However, when you do that, now nothing is going to go down your drain either.
Right, right.
Mm. So washing dishes, taking showers, and doing your regular number one and number two,
mm-hmm.
you better have alternative plans for it.
Right. Yeah, again, living out in the country, we're a little bit better situated there, and we live up on a ridge, so anything we do is going to flow downhill, so that's good. On the flip side, I found that the well that we have on our property, because we're sitting up on a ridge, we're probably the highest point in the county, static water level is about 330 feet below our feet, which means we're not going to manually pump that water to the surface. So we're going to have to find an alternate plan for getting the water that we would need.
You either have to go with solar power, hoping that the sun will be shining,
yep.
or go the Gilligan's Isle route and get one of those bicycle-type setups, because
mm-hmm.
your arms are not going to be strong enough to pump from that deep,
right?
But your legs might be.
Mm-hmm.
And there are companies that provide such equipment.
Mm. I will look into that. I did contact one about the possibility of getting a manual pump, and when I looked up the statistics on the well that was sunk about 10 years ago when the house was built, it didn't occur to me that the water was as far down as it is, but we're about 400 feet above the lake that is about 5 miles south of us, so I guess it makes sense that we're that far above the water table. Like I said, some advantages there, because anything we would need to do as far as sanitation is going to flow away more or less, but it does make getting water up to the place a little more challenging. It's
the thing about preparedness advice that you get out there now. It may be great for small disasters like earthquakes and hurricanes, but in a grid down situation, most of it's good enough to get you killed.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a presentation that, and instead of DVD, I put it on a USB drive.
Oh, okay.
This is 2 hours that I call the unprepared prepper. And it gets into things that people used to know 100 years ago or more, mm-hmm. that we don't know now, that if you don't consider it in your preps, you've got problems. And even the way they lived, it's hard to match, because they did have a supply chain. Doesn't work the same as ours. But for example, salt,
mm-hmm.
We don't give it a second thought.
Right.
But if you don't have salt, you die.
Mm-hmm.
There's only a few places in the United States where they mine salt, and only one or two of those are above ground. And then if you have animals, you need salt for animals.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if you want to raise cows, 10 cows for just 10 years, hoping that the supply chain comes back, you need a ton of salt just for that.
Yeah, I used to joke when I was in outside sales, because there were a number of Amish weld shops and metal fabrication shops, which you wouldn't expect, but they actually do really good work, that I was going to camp out on their lawn until I learned enough to keep my family alive if things ever really hit the fan. But as you say, there are probably a lot of other people who have that same idea, so I'm not sure that would be a really good solution to the problem. The idea is to start getting educated now and making some common sense plans, and the ultimate goal, of course, is to try to have enough extra so that when your neighbors are freaking out, that you can share some extra, but then also share the gospel with them. It's disturbing, and it can be frightening. So how do you, when you give these presentations, John, leave people with a message of hope?
Well, it's not like humanity has not lived without electricity and petroleum. It's just that we haven't done so in so long, we don't know how to do so, and that's deadly. So I try to encourage people to take action. Unfortunately, the way human nature is, until the disaster happens,
right.
We don't take action.
Mm-hmm.
So it still boils down to the number one on the list is have your spiritual house in order. After that, you know, like I said, the priorities, food, water, shelter, sanitation. And it gets to be the point where there's so much to learn. And what I learned from that 3-day homesteading course is that you've got a 20-year learning curve ahead of you.
Yeah.
And, you know, I probably don't have 20 years left anyway, you know, just at my age. But you don't have to try to do it all yourself. And that's where we really, especially as Christians, need to get together and do things more the way that God intended us to do things. Mm-hmm. And that can mitigate a lot of what's coming.
Mm. John, the radio program you contribute to, USA Prepares, where do people find that? And then where do people find a copy of your book, The Financial State of the Union?
The radio's on GCN, so if you go to GCNlive.com, they've got archives that are available for free. Just go in and select the dates. I'm usually on Mondays, sometimes more often. Mm. And there is somebody that takes the show and takes the commercials out and puts it up on YouTube. So you can search for USA Prepares on YouTube. You don't have a video, but you do have the audio there.
Mm-hmm.
My book is available on Amazon. And you know, like I say, I'm going to be at the Hear the Watchman conference
right here
in Dallas. And that's one of the things I'm going to get to there is, you know, ever since 2,000 years ago, every generation has thought that they're the last generation. And I'm going to explore that and give you some pretty jaw-dropping information.
Indicates that we might finally be right.
All the things that would have to change for it to not be the last generation. And Fukushima is one of those.
Yeah, that's been a bit of news that we've been paying attention to here, especially the last week when they said that the radiation level inside reactor number 2, the containment, it was about 3 times. What was it? Oh, gosh, it was like 7 times higher than the previous record high. And it's what is it? 1 sievert is enough to make you sick. 5 will kill you. And they recorded a level of what, 530 sieverts per hour?
530, and that was at a distance, so the real measurement may be higher.
Yeah.
Well. Now, just to keep you being disgusted, if you go to my news tab at thefinancialstateoftheunion.com and go to December of 2015 at, believe it was the 14th of the month, I reported on a report that was declassified, and it was only classified at for official use only. And just so you know, the base phone book is for official use only. You don't even lock these things up. But it had the weekly reports for Fukushima starting a week after and going into April, about 6-7 weeks worth. And that very first report, and Hillary and Obama were both briefed on this. You know, those first few years, we were concerned about another earthquake that would cause the spent fuel pools to release their radiation.
Mm-hmm.
On that first report, they reported that 100% of pool 3, 50% of 2, and 25% of 1 radiation was released into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They knew that then, didn't tell us. So it's bad and keeps on getting worse.
Yeah, yeah. And what I read the other day is that it appears that 80% of the total radiation from Fukushima has been released into the ocean, that reactor number 2, the grate underneath the containment vessel, has a great big 6-foot diameter hole in it where apparently the fuel dropped out of the containment vessel, which is called a containment vessel because it's supposed to contain the fuel on the inside. and dropped out, and it's now mixing with groundwater and then seeping out into the Pacific Ocean. So, yeah, there are a lot of things happening out there. It is an interesting time to be alive, not necessarily always enjoyable, but that just means that the Lord's return can't be that far off, and we pray that it's so. John, pleasure talking with you, and we look forward to meeting you at the Hear the Watchman conference coming up at the end of March, early April, and appreciate you taking time out of your day today to join us here on A View from the Bunker.
Well, thanks for having me.
Check the show notes below this video if you're watching at the YouTube channel, youtube.com/Derek Gilbert, or at the website, vftb.net. That's the basic acronym for View from the Bunker, vftb.net. And you'll find a link to John's website there, the Financial State of the Union. Just a couple of quick notes. This week, of course, NASA had its big announcement of 7 potentially habitable planets. They're calling this the TRAPPIST-1 discovery. That's the name of the telescope in Australia, or array, that helped identify this. That plus the telescope at the orbiting telescope that's being run out of Caltech, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory there. The planet, about 39 light years away, 7 planets that appear to be orbiting this dwarf star, which has, what, about 8% the mass of our sun, a small red dwarf with 7 planets that may be in a habitable zone, except that all 7 of those planets are tidally locked, meaning they always present the same face to the sun, which thus means really hot on one side, probably really cold on the other. So calling them habitable is stretching things just a little bit. But as with most things NASA does, their information releases are more about stirring up the need for, you know, just stirring up demand among you and me, the voting public, to pressure our congressmen into giving them more funding, but also to keep spreading the meme that there is life out there somewhere. And we as Christians need to be prepared to address this issue. This is a topic that we will be taking up later this year on Skywatch TV. Excuse me, at Skywatch TV, in a couple of formats. We'll be doing some programs on Skywatch about it, but we'll also got a couple of projects, I think, later this year that we will start talking about come fall that are targeting this particular topic, because it is one that most of us Christians are not prepared to address, and it is one that will lead people astray. People who just have a surface-level understanding of their doctrine won't understand why it's worth knowing anything about. And then if someday, perhaps, and I'm not saying that I believe that extraterrestrials exist, I don't, but if by some chance a legitimate unidentified flying object, a legitimate extraterrestrial craft appears in the sky above Washington, D.C., you know, as a Christian, that doesn't shake my faith, because I understand what our purpose is here on earth. But sadly, most of our fellow brothers and sisters in Christ don't. So having said that, let me also add this. If you watch Skywatch TV, you may have noticed last week I took some time to address the flat earth theory. And it was not from the standpoint of trying to debunk the flat earth theory, because, quite frankly, that is an exercise in futility. The people who are, I am not going to say anything in the span of a 15-minute program, and I think I only took about 10 minutes on that particular topic. I'm not going to say anything in the span of a one-hour program. I'm not going to say anything in the span of multiple one-hour programs that will change the mind of somebody who is really convinced that the Bible teaches a flat earth. And you know what? The Bible actually does refer to the earth in terms that make it appear to be flat. That is irrelevant, because the Bible is not a book of geology, geography, or astrophysics. God revealed himself in terms that people 3,000 years ago could understand, because they had a pagan understanding of the world being flat. I mean, that's one of the ironies here, is that, yes, while the Bible does make reference to the four corners of the earth and the firmament above, that's because that's how the entire world, the ancient Near East anyway, which is the world into which the Bible was released as the Holy Spirit inspired the prophets to write it, That was how the pagans in that place understood the world to be. So if you really want to be particular about it, you can go back and make the case that the flat earth model is really a pagan understanding of the world, and that God was simply using those terms because that was how the people of that day and age understood the world to be. It's like Paul going on Mars Hill and saying, you Greeks are very religious and you've got all these gods here. Well, let me tell you about this one over here. Instead of going up there and saying, your people, your understanding of cosmology is completely wrong. You see, people, and I can vouch for this after 20 years as a professional salesman, that people tend not to respond well when you tell them that everything they know is wrong, because in their mind what they're hearing is, this guy is calling me stupid. So, again, that was not my whole, but addressing the truth of the flat earth model was really not my point at all. My point was to say this: if you want to believe the flat earth, that the earth is flat, that's fine. I have no problem with that. Just as if you believe, and I'll probably jumping in even hotter water here, if you believe that the Bible commands us to keep the feasts and festivals that were given to Moses, that's fine. I don't interpret the Bible that way. I think the Bible is very clear on that point, especially in the books of Galatians and Hebrews, that those things were a shadow of the substance that was to come, the substance being Christ Jesus. So, but again, if keeping the feasts and festivals, if believing that the earth is flat, brings you closer to Jesus Christ, then you must follow that, if that's how the Spirit is leading you. But we have a problem that's been growing, and social media is making it worse. And that problem is that while we, followers of Jesus Christ, are essentially behind enemy lines, we're basically an encampment that is surrounded by the enemy, which, famous Marine Corps General Chesty Puller once said, simplifies our problem. You know, we're surrounded. Well, that simplifies our problem. We are surrounded. But there appears to be a body within the body that is more intent on building walls inside this surrounded camp, inside this position that is surrounded by hostile enemy forces, than in looking outward, defending the walls, and in rescuing the wounded who are on the field. And that was what I tried to raise in that discussion of the flat earth theory last week on Skywatch TV. And of course, most of the responses I got from people who believe that the earth is flat was negative, that I was trying to, that I was telling them that everything that they know was wrong and that they're stupid. And that was absolutely not what I was communicating. I bear them no ill will. I really don't. If you believe that the earth is flat, please, I'm not questioning your salvation. I'm not questioning your sanity. I'm just asking you, please, 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 let's not make this an issue to divide the body over. We got plenty of enemies outside the walls. We don't need to be making enemies inside the walls of the camp. Coming up on A View for the Bunker, we got some fascinating stuff. Gary Wayne, a guy I waited too long to bring onto the program, author of the Genesis 6 Conspiracy. The book's been out over a year now, and I just downloaded to my Kindle. My Kindle weighs about a pound and a half more now because of the book, but it's a very comprehensive look at the significance and the implications of the Genesis 6 paradigm on our world today. Fascinating discussion. We could have gone for 3 hours, kept it to an hour just to make it a manageable length, and that will be uploaded for March 12th. On March 19th, great discussion with Brian Gadawa. There's a taste of it in Thursday's update, this past Thursday's update on Skywatch TV. He's got a new series just launched, The Chronicles of the Apocalypse, and the first book is called Tyrant, Rise of the Beast, which is based on the writing of the book of Revelation by the Apostle John. So John is in this novel, Peter is in this novel, Paul is in this novel, Emperor Nero, Apollyon, king over those in the pit, and it is heavily footnoted. So you're getting a good dose of Bible-based theology while reading an interesting and engaging story as well. You may not agree with Brian's take on eschatology because he has a partial preterist view, the view that some of what we read in the Bible as end times prophecy has already been fulfilled in the first century. But he footnotes everything so that you can see that while he may disagree interpretively, you know, we're at least not disagreeing over the source material. And again, this is not something we should start building walls over. As you know, I'm sure, the timing of the rapture is one of those things that will get Christians, like Flat Earth or whether or not Christmas is pagan, fighting with one another faster than anything. It is, back to previous topic, tragic that we're living in an age now where Christians are almost more intimidated about saying Merry Christmas to other Christians than they are about saying Merry Christmas to pagans and atheists. March 26th, hope to have L.A. Marzulli on the program by then. That'll be the last program before we head off to Dallas for the Hear the Watchman conference. Of course, L.A. Marzulli, one of the featured speakers there at the conference. And then on April 2nd, assuming I have time that week to produce the program and get it uploaded in time, because that is the week we'll be traveling for the conference. April 2nd, we will be in Dallas, actually. Doug Woodward and Anthony Patch back to talk about their new DVD on CERN Decoded. What exactly is going on at the Large Hadron Collider? What is the bigger agenda there besides science? But that may be pushed off to April 9th, depending on how much work I can get done before we have to head out for Dallas. Speaking of the Hear the Watchman conference, live stream option is now available. $39 gets you the live stream of all of the speakers, and all of the presentations will be archived for 30 days afterward, so that if you have to leave during the conference or while the conference is going on, you can come back and watch whatever you missed later and watch the really interesting ones a second time. Speakers besides me, Sharon, Josh Peck, Jake Rahutsky from here at Skywatch TV include L.A., Russ Dizdar, Dr. Michael Lake, Pastor Billy Crone, Pastor Casper McLeod, Pastor Paul Begley, Pastor Mike Spaulding, John B. Wells, host of Caravan to Midnight. And by the way, Sharon and I will be guests on Caravan to Midnight this coming week, Tuesday, which is March the something or other. I'm not sure what day we are at right now. That would be 3rd and 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, March 8th, I believe. Anyway, it's Tuesday, the second Tuesday of March. We'll be the guest on Caravan to Midnight. So if you're a subscriber to John's program, you can catch us there that day. Anyway, the conference, March 31st through April 2nd, DFW Lakes Conference Center, Grapevine, Texas. That's the Dallas-Fort Worth metro area. And save $20 on your registration if you're planning to go to the conference. Save $20 when you register by using the promo code SKYWATCH. Our weekly Bible study, the Gilbert House Fellowship, continues on Sunday with two new studies, one Old Testament, one new. We're in 2 Kings, the history in the Old Testament, the New Testament study, going through the epistles and getting close to the book of Revelation. So we'll be digging into prophecy before the month of March is out. And that should slow down our schedule. I mean, we've got a posted schedule at gilberthouse.org where all the studies are archived, but I guarantee it's going to slow down because we're probably going to take more time on Revelation than we scheduled for. But we'll see how that goes. Skywatch TV this coming week, another fascinating discussion. Mike Heiser is the guest. Well, actually, I'm the guest, too. They moved me to one of the guest chairs. It felt really weird. Mike and I talking about our new books, Reversing Herman and The Great Inception. You'll see that on Skywatch TV this coming week. The Roku episode will go up on Monday morning, and the broadcast episodes. Get a complete list of dates and times at skywatchtv.com. Look in the top menu bar where it says Channels. We do appreciate you taking the time to leave a review and a rating wherever you find View from the Bunker, whether it's iTunes, Stitcher, or anywhere else. And, of course, the Facebook page, facebook.com/viewfromthebunker. Leave us a comment there and give us a like. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House, released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod and the opening narration by DC Good. Remember, we wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.